How drunk was I last night? Ethan can't contain his joy at the idea of me telling some chick about him, and he practically drools all over Karen Minty. She wastes no time making herself at home, and she looks at me. So how do you take coffee, Joe? I tell her I'm fine, and she rolls her eyes and winks at me and calls. Hey, Ethan? He trips over himself running back. Only Ethan. And he tells her that I'm black, two sugars, and he's cream and stevia, or Truvia, or Splenda. And if they don't have any of that, the real sugar in brown packets, but never equal. All the while, Karen is looking deep into my eyes, and she thinks she's going to bring me coffee for the rest of her life. I love you, not her. And oh, fuck, she's one of those girls. She smiles at me hard and winks.
Thanks, Ethan.
And there's no way around it. I didn't just pet this cat. I adopted it. Chapter 36. Being with Karen is shockingly effective, at least in the sense that you're farther and farther away from me. I try to see the good in it. I get to practice being a boyfriend, and that's good for us. But I do feel bad when I'm caressing her ass in bed and folding her thongs at the laundromat and sending her mother a handwritten thank you note after Sunday dinner. It's wrong of me to betray you. But know this, Beck. Every day I find a way to visit the pictures of you in my phone. I'm faithful. 7 weeks into life with Karen Minty and 11 weeks into therapy, and Nikki thinks I'm making good progress. I'm not as depressed anymore. I read your email, and I know you're still doing your thing. No booze, no shopping. And now that I'm seeing Dr. Nikki, I totally get why he makes you want to focus. You look so much happier than you were the day you started in here, Danny. Thanks, I say. I feel happier. And things are good with Karen? Things are great with Karen, I say, and they are, technically. Nikki laughed when I first told him about her. He said a girl is a much more effective cat than another YouTube video. He's right. I know that look, Danny, he grins. After I met my wife, I don't think I stopped smiling for 2 years. I blurt, oh, we're not going to get married, Nikki. He gets that know-it-all look, and I go further. I just mean, she's not it for me. He pushes. Now you don't look so happy. Are you afraid to get married? Not at all. And it's true. I'd marry you in a heartbeat. So, what's wrong with Karen, Danny? She's not you. She's just... nothing. She's nothing, he says, and he raises his eyebrows. Ouch. I groan. I meant that nothing is wrong with her. Regardless, he says, and that's how I know our time is up. I got some homework for you. I want a list of 10 things... you like about Karen. The cat helps the mouse stay away, and remember, thinking about the cat is better than thinking about the mouse. Okay, Doc, I say, and the Doc thing is our running joke, you know, because he's not a doctor. I try to do my homework on the ride home, but I just keep thinking about you. I'm still trying a few days later as I sit on the couch watching Karen Minty's favorite show, The King of Queens. She laughs at a joke that wouldn't make you smile, and I love you because you don't laugh easily. She picks her thong out of her ass, and I love you for your healthy cotton panties. She moans, I fucking love Kevin James. He's good, I lie. I love you because you don't love Kevin James, and if you laughed at one of his jokes, you still wouldn't love him. A Burger King commercial comes on. Karen Minty fucking loves commercials. And she flips the bird at the TV. Bite me, BK. BK fries suck, right, Joe? I play along and laugh, but I love you because we could be married 100 years and you'd never ask me what I think about BK fries because you'd never say BK, and if you were talking about French fries, there would be more to it than fries. They would have significance. There would be a story there. You're an onion and Karen's a maraschino cherry, and I love you because onions are more complicated than cherries. I'm doomed. I almost forgot that Karen Minty's head is on my lap, and she peers up at me. Babe, you all right? Yeah. And I run my hand through her hair the way she likes. I'm just thinking about my homework. Karen doesn't approve.
I swear, Joe, I think that shit's a waste of money.
I know you do. At the hospital, all the fuck-ups are shrinks. Every one of them. They're fucking cheaters and liars, and they're crazier than their patients. No, he's not like that, I say. She huffs. Like fuck he's not. They're cheaters and liars, Joe. Cheaters and liars. You never repeat yourself, because you're creative, and Karen is not, and she pinches my nipple. Joe! Look at me. I look at her. Watch it, miss. What do you talk about in there anyway? I mean, you're perfect, Joey. Nobody's perfect. I sound like a teacher. And I get a little OCD.
Yeah, Karen Minty laughs. You are OCD. On my pussy.
You would never say anything so crass. And I pet Karen Minty and watch Kevin James, and I miss you so much I feel sick. Suddenly I have to go. I stand up.
Whoa, where's the fire?
She hugs my seat cushion. She's too needy. I'm going to the store, I say, and I grab my keys.
You want company?
She's not mysterious. No, I say, and I grab my coat.
You need cash?
She sits up. She's pathetic. No, I say. Stay put. I'll be back in a bit. I run down the stairs and I stop. I could do anything to Karen Minty and she'd stay. She has her claws in me, Beck. Her mother is knitting me a sweater and her father wants to take me out on his boat one of these Sundays. I sit down on the stoop. Maybe now that I'm away from Karen Minty, I can make a list of things that I like about her. Number one, Karen Minty grew up with three brothers, so she's mellow. And it's true, she is mellow. FedEx fucks up the new Nora Roberts, and I can put Karen on a subway and send her uptown, and she'll haul ass up there and drag a box of books back on the subway, up the stairs, and to the shop. And if I ask her to, Karen will unload the books, price them, and stack them. She doesn't complain, Beck. She wants to be asked. Like a little brat trying to do good on Christmas Eve in case Santa is watching. I can even ask her to get out the Swiffer and clean up the dust she noticed while she was stacking. Number two, Karen Minty likes to clean.
I grew up in a fucking pigsty, she likes to say. Only way shit gets clean is if I clean it, and I like shit clean, so there you go.
Number three, Karen Minty likes to cook, and she's good at it. I haven't eaten like this in I don't know how long, real family food. A lasagna that will taste good even 5 days later, cold. And the runner's body I had going when I was tracking Pete Salinger, who would be absolutely horrified by Karen. Well, I still have it for the most part, because Karen likes to cook, eat, clean, and fuck. And she intends to do all these things with me forever. I found a little plastic file box of recipes that belonged to her mother. I texted her about the recipes, and she wrote back,
I'm cooking a hell of a lot more in your kitchen than I am in mine.
Anything I want, anytime. And I can ask her for it, and she can make it, because her mother knows how to make everything. I brought leftover lasagna for Ethan, and he thinks her mother should do a cookbook. She is that good. Number four, Karen Minty is a good fuck. The way you like to talk shit about Blythe, the way that you like to tease, your nipples popping in the shop on day one. Well, Karen Minty just likes to ride dick, all dick. You can tell she's been fucked a lot, and it doesn't bother me. I'm the best she's ever had. Her words, not mine. Number five, Karen Minty knows Ethan is good people. We went out with Blythe and Ethan once. It was bad. Blythe balked at Karen's greyhounds and told her that Leonardo DiCaprio drinks a lot of beverages, Karen. Are you that naive? Ouch. The next day, Ethan showed up at the shop apologizing. Blythe doesn't have a lot of girlfriends. I hope Karen isn't hurt. And Karen popped in while he was there. Karen told Ethan that Blythe is super smart and wicked pretty. When Ethan went to go take a shit, Karen told me that she thought Blythe was a cunt.
Ethan should be with a nice girl, she said. But nice guys always get with bitches. They don't break up if you call them out on it. Give him time. He'll dump her eventually.
Karen Minty truly is a nurse. A couple of days ago, he asked me, in complete seriousness, if I plan to propose to Karen. Ethan, it's been 2 months. He shrugged and told me for the 50th time how he proposed to his ex Shelley after 6 weeks. I told him straight, and look how that turned out.
When you know, you know.
Well, I don't know, Ethan.
Well, you better start thinking about knowing,
he said, and for once he had a 5 o'clock shadow, another miracle.
Because she definitely knows.
Number six.
It's no use. Maybe Dan Fox loves Karen Minty, but I don't love Karen Minty. I love you. I love your depth and your letters to yourself, and I am wrong to be leading her on. And honestly, she comes on too strong. Otherwise, why would Ethan and Nikki be talking about marriage when we've been going out less than 2 months? And here she comes, bounding down the apartment building stairs after me. Boo! She screams. And I flinch, even though I knew she was coming. Oh my God, you scare so freaking easily, she laughs. She sits down next to me and leans her head on my shoulder and she sighs. I don't scare at all. When I was a kid, my brothers tried to fuck with me so much that, I don't know. I think I just, like, lost all my fear or something.
It's a nice night. There are kids playing outside. It'll be spring before you know it. Karen Minty yawns.
What a night, right?
Yeah, I say. She hears the timer on the oven and she pulls me close and plants one of her hard, bossy kisses on me.
You want enchiladas?
Do I ever not want enchiladas? I say, and I get another kiss.
Well, come on, she says. First enchiladas, then you promised you'd help me with my flashcards.
I pocket my store keys and follow her back up the stairs to my place. Number 7, Karen Minty has a great ass. Number 8, Karen Minty makes great enchiladas. Number 9, Karen Minty mixes sexual favor cards in with her nursing school flashcards so that randomly, I'll flash her a card that says, take my top off. Number 10, Karen Minty likes to fuck. After we fuck, I look at my list and realize that I left off number 6. Number 6, Karen Minty knows what she wants. She wants to be a phlebotomist. She doesn't complain about her homework because she knows what she wants. She wants to draw blood from people. She wants to be a phlebotomist.
I'm a great fucking stick, and when you're laid up in bed for 8 days with fucked veins and your IV jams because some dumb tramp messed up your meds, the most important thing in the world to you is a great stick. Not a great doctor, a great stick. And I want to be the stick around the fucking world.
Do you see that, Beck? It's not like she wants to tweet about being a nurse.
Fucking twit in my ass. I prefer life,
she said just the other day. There's a simplicity to it all that is really good for me, and I know it because my cheeks are flushed. My belly is full. My dick is the stick heard around the fucking world. Just ask Karen. And I wake up and I want to get out of bed and do my life. But I also wake up thinking about you. I finish reading my list to Dr. Nikki. At first, he doesn't say anything. I am impatient. What's up, Doc?
You tell me, Danny.
I did my homework, now it's your turn. Dr. Nikki just stares at me, and I just stare at Dr. Nikki. Does he do this to you? Okay, Danny, I'm gonna ask you something. He leans in. Does Karen know that you're not in love with her? I can't lie to him about Karen. He can't help me unless I tell the truth. No, I say. She doesn't know.
Lies don't pave the way to joy, he says.
And sometimes he reminds me of a rabbi, and I can't believe I used to think that you had sex with him.
And if there's anything I've learned in almost 50 years on this planet, it's this. If you don't start with crazy, crazy love, the kind of love that Van Morrison sings about, then you don't have a shot to go the distance. Love's a marathon, Danny, not a sprint.
I blurt, what about you? Do you love your wife?
No, he says, super quick.
But I did. On the way home from therapy, I'm depressed and I check your email. You RSVP'd yes to a birthday party at an upscale bowling alley for assholes. I know that you won't go. You never go anywhere anymore. You only go to Dr. Nikki's because he's Dr. Nikki. But I know that Karen Minty will go with me to the bowling alley and sit there until I say it's time to go home. She sits with me at the hipster bar near the lanes, and we don't belong. We are the only people who are not a part of the party. They are all around us, talking about Lena Dunham's wardrobe.
Who's Lena Dunning?
Karen Minty wants to know. And they talk about the alpha male's vintage suspenders. Karen Minty chews on her straw and shrugs. And they talk about campus dance at Brown. Karen Minty plays a game with Jules on her phone. You don't show up at the party, and Karen Minty is in love with me, and I don't love her back. I can't. It's been so long since I've seen you, and life would be easier if I could turn into a fan of the King of Queens. But I can't, Beck. And you, of all people, would understand. It's like the letter you wrote to yourself today.
Dear Beck, Louisa May Alcott is right. An extraordinary girl can't have an ordinary life. Don't judge yourself. Love yourself. Love Beck.
Chapter 37. I've read enough books and seen enough movies to know that Nicky fucked up when he told me about his wife. I'm not surprised when he tells me we need to talk. He accepts full responsibility for the breach, for crossing the patient-therapist boundary. I've never seen the guy look worse, Beck, and he's such a good person, like Mr. Mooney back in the day, before he got angry at me, at life. I can't stand to hear him cut himself down. I plead, hey, come on, Doc, stop beating yourself up already. I can't tell if he's laughing or crying, and he might be the only guy on earth who can do those two things at once. He's a juggler, and God bless him, because I could never apologize to another dude for saying one freaking thing about my own life. Danny, he says, all I can do for you now is give you a referral. You want a referral? There are pit stains on his shirt, and his clothes are wrinkled, as if he's been in them for too long. I know how to cheer him up, and I tell him I don't need a referral because I'm better. He smiles. I go on. I tell him I don't have a mouse in my house because he's the best shrink ever. How's it going with Karen? It's good, I say. I want him to feel accomplished. Seriously, the mouse is dead. Wow, he says, and somehow he sounds jealous. Or maybe he's just sad. I tell him that his mouse-cat theory is genius, and he likes that I use that word, genius. Of course, I don't tell him that I want to cover myself in cheese and peanut butter in order to get the mouse to come back. He deserves better. I'm happy for you, Danny, he says. You worked hard, and you did your homework, and this is all you, kid. Figuring out what makes you happy is a journey. You make me happy, I nod. You said it. Being obsessed didn't make you happy, Nicky continues. And you knew that. And more important, you acted on that knowledge and decided to rise above your obsession. You're smart, Danny. I can't thank you enough, Doc. I wish we were all as smart as you, he says, and he has that sad, glossy-eyed look again, as he talks about how hard it is to make a mouse go away. I'm sitting and thinking about you, my beloved mouse. Nicky is right. You might never show up again. You might be gone. I know it's possible that you've moved on. You could even be seeing someone. But the most important thing I know is that I want the possibility of you more than the reality of Karen Minty. And what can I say, Danny? I'm also so happy your cat worked out, he says. When you came in here, I was worried. You did not look well. You looked like a prisoner. I felt like one, I say, and I did. I do. But then, you got yourself a cat, he says. Amen, I say. I picture Karen Minty on all fours, with your little body hanging out of her mouth. Hey, I went on YouTube and watched that Honey Drippers video today, right before you got here, he says, and his eyes pop. I can understand your obsession. That video is trippy. That guy in his Speedo, that jacket. What is that jacket doing on that hanger? We laugh, but his sadness is like a fever that shows up in his eyes, in his mouth. I feel bad about lying, and his phone buzzes. I'm sorry, he says, but I have to check it. He says he has to step out, shit hitting the fan at home. Now that he has broken the doctor-patient dynamic, he can overshare again, and he promises to be back in 5 minutes. He closes the door, and immediately I look at his computer. I wanted inside that computer the first time I stepped into this room. You live in there somewhere, and the temptation to find the sea of love is overwhelming. I would swear that you were calling from inside the hard drive, luring me to your own sea, and I can't help it. I really am like the guy in the video. And this is it, my big chance. I've never been alone in here, and fuck it, I run over to Nikki's desk, and I tap the space bar and dive in. Looking at the screensaver family snapshot of Nicky with his wife and his daughters makes me feel guilty. I'm violating our trust, and Nicky's family is so innocent, lined up in front of Nicky's Pizza in Chestertown, New York. There's something pathetic about a grown man forcing his wife and daughters to pose on a rainy day in front of a pizza place just because it's called Nicky's. I feel for the guy, but I want you, and I minimize the Honey Drippers video. He's a good man, he really was looking at it. And I search the hard drive. Wow. Dr. Nicky doesn't write about my sessions, or your sessions, or anyone's sessions. He just dictates his thoughts into his iPhone and downloads the MP3 files onto his computer. There is a folder called G. Beck with a bunch of audio files. I get that Van Morrison feeling that Nikki was talking about. I send myself the folder. I delete the email in his sent folder. I empty the trash. I made it. But I didn't. It's over. I fucked up. Nikki's back with a disappointed smile and he sighs. Danny, I'm so sorry. This is my fault. I tell you the video's here and I leave. I'm losing it, Danny. I breathe. I made it after all. No, you're not, Doc, I say, and I mean it. He looks weak and his voice is unsteady. How about that referral? I take the referral and shake his hand and leave. I am sad for Nikki, but nothing can touch my excitement over the files, G. Beck. In the elevator, I do something I never do. I pray for Nikki to find someone who can give him that Van Morrison feeling so that his bleached teeth won't seem so laughably out of place on his drawn, sad face. The elevator dumps me in the lobby, and Danny Fox is dead. When I step outside, I stumble, a fucking crack in the sidewalk. There is a black hole in my mind. Am I nuts? I could just keep eating Karen's eggs and Karen's pussy. I could start over with Nikki's referral and try to live life without you. I could. But the truth is, cats bore me. I'd rather listen to tapes of Nikki talking about you than have intercourse with Karen Minty. And if Van Morrison's not crazy, then neither am I. Dear Joe, you are not a cat person. You want a mouse. Love, Joe. Chapter 38. I have to buy headphones at a fucking deli because I have to know now what Nikki has said about you. And the guy takes forever, and why do so many morons go into customer service? And I grab the headphones and mutter, "Thanks, asshole." And I'm out of there, and I tear into the package, and it's sealed too tight, and I scream, and a few people on the street back away from me like I'm the Hulk, busting out of his dress shirt. And I duck into the alley and take the time to crack the plastic and get the headphones out and throw away the instructions, and I can't get them into my phone fast enough as I run down the stairs and swipe my Metro card and hit play on the first MP3 as I step onto the train and sit down across from a blind black guy who smiles for no reason. Okay, day one, Beck. Female, early to mid-20s, hypersexualized, boundary issues, father issues, claims to be here to resolve her issues with men, but doesn't seem to realize that I have a ring on my finger. Only mode of communication is seduction. Repeatedly crosses her legs and wears a flimsy shirt without a bra. Attention-seeking, directly asks about transference, severe narcissistic disorder. Insists on calling me Dr. Nikki in spite of my repeated statements that I am not an MD. Repeatedly asks if I'm married and if I have a good sex life with my wife to avoid discussing her own life. Tells me she slept with her therapist in college. Repeatedly, I ask why she doesn't see a female clinician and she says she has one mother, doesn't need another. Possible borderline, predatory, masochistic tendencies. The blind black guy is staring at me, but he's blind and he can't see me, and I can't get mad at him. And I skip ahead to another segment. Maybe the next one will be better. It has to be. Marcia was a fucking nightmare this morning. Mac overslept again, and Amy has the flu, and Marcia is just incompetent as a mother. I almost canceled but found myself soothed by knowing that I would see Beck. I've grown to look forward to my time with this young woman. I find myself counting down, thinking about what I'll wear that day. She makes my life bearable, damn it. Now who's asking about transference? Today she presents in sweatpants and a formless top with messy hair and shiny skin. I can't help but feel that she dressed down for me, which is more intimate than dressing up for me. We establish goals. She wants sexual confidence, which I find amusing because she is sex. I hit pause, and I want the black man to stop smiling. I want the world to stop smiling. I fast forward. I hit play. She claims that I have opened her up and that she's taking a much-needed break from men, that she's realized things about her father, things about her love life, and all of this after just a few sessions because I am the most amazing doctor she has ever had. I tell her again I'm not a doctor. Is it terrible that I love it when she calls me Dr. Nikki? Don't answer that. Anyway, I tell her that there is no magic cure. She shakes me off. She says I have lit up something inside of her. She says she has never felt so in tune with herself. She says talking to me is the time of her life. She is presenting more sexually, in knee socks and skirts. I think she knows I'm falling for her. And my God, I think she's falling for me. I think about her too much. And sometimes I worry that she knows. I should stop therapy, but I can't. I am so tired of Marcia and the broken washing machine, and Beck is a reprieve. I hit pause. I look around. I wish there was someone I could punch in the face. I could never punch a blind man. And I press play. I know I should give her a referral and send her on her way. I hit pause again because I'm going deaf from anger. He had no problem giving me a referral. It's fine to kick Danny Fox to the curb, but you get to stay. I press play. Her journaling is productive. She is receptive to my suggestion that she needs to be in a relationship in order to address her issues. She repeatedly tells me that we have a connection. And I don't encourage her, but this connection is all I think about. How come I am so willing to accept failure in my work? Yet I am not willing to accept it when a very intelligent patient calls me a genius. Maybe I did cure her in a matter of weeks. Has my self-esteem tumbled to the extent that I no longer think that's possible just because I bought the wrong washing machine? He loves you, and he's after you, and the blind man is smiling, now standing, poking around, and we're all hunters, we are, and I skip ahead. I tell Diane that I'm starting to have dreams about Beck, and of course Diane tells me to stop treatment. That's what a good therapist would say, and Diane is a good therapist, but I can't. Beck is opening up to me, and she trusts me enough to tell me about this green pillow she uses to masturbate. To masturbate! The backstory is revelatory. Her father left. He then asked her mother to mail him his green neck pillow. Her passive mother agreed, but Beck had already stolen the pillow. In my fantasy, we are in my office, and she comes over to me and asks to sit on my lap. I say no, but she will not be stopped. She straddles me. I fantasize about her all the time now. And the bad washing machine is actually good because there's a lock in the laundry room and I can jerk off in there and think about Beck without getting caught. In my mind, when I'm inside of her, she calls me a rock star and a cock star, and I haven't felt this alive in years. Staying with Marcia feels more like a betrayal, like I am cheating on Beck even though nothing is happening. Every day, I am more detached from my family. The truth is ugly. I would rather have Beck. At some point during that recording, the blind man exited the train. I missed my stop, and the headphones jammed my ears, pieces of dime store junk, and I yanked them out of my phone and hurled them at the window across from me. People are looking at me, and people can fuck off. The train lurches to a stop, and I'm the first one out the door. I can't get angrier than I am right now. I feel like a sucker, and I want to tear my own head off because I can't believe that I fell for his bullshit. I can't believe I told him things I never tell anyone. I round the corner and see Karen fucking Minty sitting on my fucking stoop with a picnic basket, and cats are supposed to be smarter than this, colder than this.
Surprise, she says. I made a picnic.
And can you believe that Karen still exists? I want to go inside and throw typewriters at the walls until they cave in and the mice are collateral damage. Falling to death, screaming, and Karen Minty, my girlfriend, has to be here with an actual picnic basket. I've never seen one in real life, only in cartoons, in books, and I don't want to go on a picnic. I smell garlic and rosemary and the noxzema that Karen has rubbed all over her tight, pointy face since she was a kid. It's over. If she knew what a sucker I am, if she knew that I paid a married dickwad to try and fuck the love of my life, she wouldn't want to take me on a picnic. I need her to go away. This has nothing to do with her. This is Nikki's fault, and I tell her I'm not hungry. She is hungry, and she reaches, and I pull away.
Joe, what the fuck?
I'm not Joe. I'm Dan Fox, and I am loud. Jesus Christ, Karen! Can you take a fucking hint? And that's it. She is on her feet, shivering.
Fuck you.
That's intelligent.
Fuck you and your intelligence, she snarls.
You think I'm some doormat piece of shit chick that you can bang and fuck as you please? You think I'm some fucking rag doll?
Yes, I say, not missing a beat. That's exactly what you are. And it's true, I am wrong about everyone. You are a whore. And Nikki is a prick. And sweet Karen, the cum dumpster, is boiling over with repressed rage. Or is that sadness? She is quivering, and the basket is making her forearm tremble, and I'm a fucking asshole, and she's a phlebotomist who loves me. Me. And if Nikki wasn't in love with you, then none of this would be happening. But he does want you, and that chicken smells delicious, and I'm a fool.
Sit down, says Karen Minty, and I let her help me onto the stoop.
How could Nikki do this to Karen? She is a hard worker. The basket is full. She has heart. Last month, she lugged a vacuum cleaner all the way here to my place. She vacuumed beneath the sofa. She wore tiny little horse shorts and a half shirt, and she found dirty places I didn't know existed.
You don't want to get mice, she had said. Otherwise, I won't want to come here anymore.
Nobody ever made a vacuum cleaner into a dozen roses, a beating heart. And like everything bad, this too is Nikki's fault. He's the one who told me to get a cat. Karen would stay with me forever and pump out kids when I want kids and work doubles so we can go to Florida once a year. And I have all of this here in a picnic basket, and that rosemary smells like heaven. But the thing is, she's never heard of Paula Fox or Magnolia or tried to bang her married shrink. She's not different hot like us. She follows the rules. She doesn't dare touch the hole in my wall because that's
for the super to fix.
She respects boundaries, and fuck Nikki for wasting her time and breaking her heart.
Why are you mad at me? She's quivering. I thought you'd think it was cool, a picnic. It's gorgeous out.
Karen?
Oh, fuck, she says, and she knows I'm dumping her.
She leaps off the stoop, and she's running, crying, gone. I will never see her again. And I take the picnic basket upstairs and spread it all out in my minty fresh apartment. I gorge on chicken breasts and roasted potatoes and cauliflower and cream sauce and wine right out of the bottle. I eat like it's the Last Supper, because it is. I buried Dan Fox today, and now I have to take care of Nikki. There's no way around it, Beck. I listen to his recordings all night long. He's taken advantage of you in the safest place in the world. He's in your head, a mouse in your house, and he's clearly tricked you into thinking that you love him. We can't get together with him controlling your thoughts. Dr. Nikki is Dr. Nikki, a greedy, married pig. And he was wrong about me. I don't have a mouse in my house. I have a fucking pig. Chapter 39. I don't remember the last time I was this close to a school. A lot's changed. PS 87 on 78th Street has a slogan, for fuck's sake. One family under the sun. I spent the early morning on the steps of the American Museum of Natural History, drinking coffee and learning about Nikki, and waiting for the families to get out of bed and under the sun already. The journey to this school was shockingly easy, thanks largely to Nikki's sister-in-law, Jackie. I found her on the Yelp page for Nikki's Pizza, where she has contributed countless photographs of our extended family gorging on our favorite za. Jackie's Yelp account led me to Jackie's bountiful Facebook page, which features numerous check-ins at the cabins upstate, at Nikki's Pizza, duh, and most important, to PS 87. Best school in the city. Best Facebook page in the world. Really, I should sign into Yelp just to endorse her foamy, panting restaurant reviews. I owe her. I know everything about Nikki. So, I'm dressed up like a runner today, because if there's anywhere in the world you can't chill out undisturbed, it's a school. I'm fucking out of shape as all get out. I haven't run since Peach. I've been running in circles, jogging really, since 4:30 in the morning, listening to Nikki's fucking perv diaries to keep me focused. I go down Columbus, bang a right onto 77th, past the empty playground, turn right up Amsterdam, and then right onto 78th, past PS 87, and do it again. I've made I don't know how many laps when it all pays off because I see Nikki walking down the street. He looks different to me now. I used to feel sorry for him, the way he was so hunched over, his eyes hell-bent on the floor. But now he just looks evil. His hunchback is a punishment for his sins, you. A father should be looking out for his daughter, but Nikki hangs his head. His daughters are older now, and that picture on his computer must have been taken a while ago. He's holding Amy's hand. Amy's the one they had instead of getting divorced. And calling out for Mac to slow down. Mac's the one they had to seal the deal. Older, detached. It's okay for me to jog in place, because I'm wearing sunglasses and headphones, and if there's one dude that everyone on the Upper West Side will welcome with open arms, it's the fucking jogger. Nikki walks these kids into the school, and what happened to this city that parents are fucking inside of the school with the kids? Nobody held my fucking hand, or anybody else's for that matter, back in the day. And a mother glares at me, and I wave and smile. I normal up good. And she waves, assuming she forgot my name, and knows me from the PTA, or the gym, or what have you. And come on, Nikki! Get out of there, because jogging in place is not like jogging in circles, and we've got work to do. Me and Nikki. And we don't have much time, because you're supposed to see Nikki tomorrow afternoon at 1, and I've decided that that's not going to happen. Nikki is living proof that idle hands are the horny, cheating devil's playground. The guy's so leisurely, Beck. After he dropped his girls at school, he took the long way home and talked on the phone, to you? And then disappeared into his building. I didn't see anyone buzz his play, so it's not like he was seeing patients. He and his wife came out 3 hours later, squawking over the washing machine. This is why marriage scares me. They've been talking about that malfunctioning machine for months. And I stay with them on their walk. If Nikki had balls, he would leave her, but he doesn't. And I'm not mad at you for falling for him. I don't blame you. The more I listen to the tapes, the more I see Nikki for what he is. A very talented, very sick manipulator. I didn't see through his bullshit, so I can't very well blame you for falling under his spell. And if you think about it, it's kind of sweet that we both got swindled. We're alike. I smile. Nikki's wife, Marcia, is nothing like you. She's boorish and loud. She teaches psychology at various local and online colleges. She's a thick-legged martyr with a yoga mat over her shoulder. I hate to sound crass, but yoga's not doing the trick. She's wearing a Stop Breast Cancer visor. You know this woman is always bellyaching about something. And her hair is tied back in a low, sad ponytail. This is not a happy woman, Beck. She's gruff. She crosses her arms when they pass by homeless people, as if the homeless people would ever even try with her. I could feel sorry for Nikki, but the facts are facts. At some point in his life, he proposed to Marcia. Watching him trot alongside Marcia is depressing. She does all the talking about birthday parties and pediatricians and kiddie yoga classes, as if kids don't stretch out on their own. There are vitamins to be bought and babysitters to be fired, and poor Nikki is hunched over more with every block. When I do finally kill him, I will be putting him out of his misery. You don't want him, Beck. Life does not suit him. All that power he has in the beige room with the records on the wall disappears when he exits his playroom. He wants to cross, but his wife yanks his arm. She snaps, "Green light!" They cross when it's safe, LOL. And they enter a nondescript townhouse. I googled the address, and naturally, they're here for couples therapy. 52 minutes later, they emerge, deflated. They walk in silence to a gym, and they hug, family style, before she disappears into her refuge of yoga and like-minded women. I follow Nikki down the street, and he is less hunched every block. He arrives at his destination, Westsider Books. And he emerges an hour later, standing up straight with 3 new used records and no books. Tisk tisk. I follow him until we reach Urban Outfitters, and he goes in with his bag of records and looks at all the clothes and tries on t-shirts and shazams one song after another, and finally he leaves without buying a thing. Now it's off to school, where he picks up his daughters and walks them back home. The young one is happy and talking, and the old one is morose and not talking, and people have to be careful or they wind up with lives they didn't want. It's lucky we found each other when we did, you and me. I hang out by his building like I'm waiting for a running buddy. Here comes Marcia with a friend whose taste in clothing is equally drab. Marcia sighs, and it's clear to me that she sighs a lot. He said that he would sooner kill himself than leave his children. And what did you say? I said I think that all children do better with happy parents than married parents.
I said there's no stigma about divorce anymore.
The friend nods in agreement and her ring sparkles. Marcia goes on.
And then he said it's easy for me to be cavalier about divorce because my parents were happily married. But you know Nikki the martyr. His children will never deal with a divorce.
The friend sighs. Women sigh. A lot. She lightens.
Maybe you should start a profile for him on Match.
The ladies share a laugh and the friend says she was only kidding. There are no easy answers, and they make plans to get their families together because that sounds like fun. And Marcia plods up to the home she doesn't want, to the man she doesn't love. Now I know why Nikki became a shrink, for real. He needed someone to talk to because he married the wrong woman. He knew he was giving up on his music, but he didn't know he was giving up on love. I am starting to feel sorry for him again, because I'm a pushover. I duck into the subway and watch a couple of nurses bitch about work. I think of my nurse, Karen, and how miserable she must be right now. I can't tell you what a relief it is to arrive back in my hood. Killing Nikki is going to be difficult, but it's necessary. You're obsessed with him. He's a mouse in your house. And because of my current thought process, I almost freak out when I see a cop on my stoop. He blocks the front door, and he is a giant, and my brain freezes up on me, Benji Peach Candace mug of urine. And it's me he's looking for. Like Ethan says, when you know, you know. This giant cop has his nightstick out, and he's not fucking around. Is that you, Joe? It takes everything I have left in me to walk toward this man when all I want to do is run. Get over here, he says. The sad thing about being poor is that the few little hood kids running around don't even react. This is just another day. Can I help you? I say, because I am innocent. I am. I wish I were Dan Fox, but he's no good either. Not anymore. Yeah, you can help me, he says as I walk up the steps. I stand directly across from him now. His pores are enormous, and his forearms are bigger than mine are, and his neck is veiny, and I bet his dad was a cop, and his granddad too. You can tell me who the fuck you think you are. I say, and might piss my pants. What is this about? He mocks me. What is this about? It happens so fast. He grabs me by the collar and yanks me close. His breath is made of onions, raw onions. He seethes. You little fuck. Am I gonna die? I close my eyes, and he tightens his grip on my shirt. I'm innocent. Innocent until proven guilty. He spits at me. And then he lets go. I don't wipe my face, and I take a step back. He slams his stick into the cement. You know. You better respect this uniform, kid. Because if I wasn't in this uniform, I'd kick your ass and throw your bones in the dumpster over there and see to it that nobody finds you. I'm sorry, I stammer. And he probably hates me more for my yuppie running clothes, and he shakes his head. You know, my sister... He's blubbering, crackling, and now I recognize his cadence. It's Minty. My sister... Karen is a fucking saint, you prick. She's as beautiful inside as she is outside, and you, you little pansy, you got no right. Sister, and I can breathe again, and I'm begging for his forgiveness and telling him she was too good for me, and he doesn't buy it. I shut up. You don't fuck over Karen Elise Minty. He raises his stick, and I cower, and I don't want to die. I can't leave you like this. He slams his stick into the concrete by my feet. Stand up, you fucking pussy! He grabs me by the throat. And this, too, is on Nikki. He's the one who pushed me on Karen and then made me push her away. The giant Minty cop clenches my throat. Let's go. And smashes the concrete one last time with his stick. He storms away. And no wonder Karen Minty wants to be a phlebotomist. Her brother's got a good stick. Why shouldn't she have one, too? Chapter 40. Taking care of Nikki is going to be easier than I thought. He's a do-gooder, Beck, and once a week he takes the train out to the part of Queens that's still all about crack and crime to counsel druggies who are trying to get sober. But tonight he's going to become a cautionary tale for all the Upper West Side assholes who think they can atone for their sins with 4 hours a week. Tonight, Nikki, not a doctor except to you, will be mugged by drug addicts. I take a swig of Jack and open the front page of a self-help book. When bad things happen to good people. Nikki Angevine's friends will give his wife that book when he's found dead in Queens. Nikki's death will be looked upon as a tragedy. His daughters will grow up without a father, until his wife bangs a replacement, which will probably happen in a matter of weeks, and there will be a simple, perverse beauty to his demise. No suspects, no confusion, no malfeasance, a straight-up mugging, wallet gone, the guy was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Marcia Angevine's friends will hover around her with coffee cakes and their own kids and bottles of wine and tell her how sorry they are for her loss. But I know that she'll be thanking the Lord for her gain. It's time, Beck. Nikki emerges from the sober house and looks both ways like a good little white boy. He hangs his head and starts down the street, and his wife must have laundered his Vans because they're especially bright and white tonight. He's a mouse in your house, and I wish you didn't want him, but of course you do, Beck. He's like the father you never had, and you want to break up his family. And that's natural. That's the cycle of abuse, and it was Nikki's job to help you overcome that desire. But Nikki didn't do his job. He is a pig, and there's no possible happy ending to this mess. If I let him live, you will eventually get what you think you want. He will fuck you in the beige room and cry to his wife and beg for a divorce, and he will go to you. Because he's right, you are sex. And the truth is, the second he becomes available, no ring, no more teeth whitening, you won't want him. He is leading you down the path to hell, and he was supposed to keep his distance from you, and he didn't. And you were supposed to call me, you miss me, and you didn't. And I know you so well, Beck. You are charisma, you are sick, and for some reason you are a magnet for weak, spineless people like Peach, like Benji, like Nikki. I pick up my pace and I hold my new nightstick. I went to the Army-Navy store to cool off after that bullshit with Officer Minty. It's only fair that we all be armed against cops who think they're above the law. I clench my jaw. I am gaining on him and I can do this. One fell swoop. But then I feel a vibration in my pocket. I have no choice but to duck into an alley. Nikki will turn around if he hears the phone, and I can't make it stop, and I can't breathe, and my hands shake, and I look at my phone. It's you. You are calling me. You have, at last, decided to act on your feelings. Your name looks beautiful in my phone, shining in the dark above the picture of you in your white bikini. I stare at you, aglow. I smile. I too glow. You surprise me, you delight me, and you miss me. I try to make my heart slow down, and Dr. Nikki is already blocks away, and I bring the phone to my head and I speak. Well, hello, Beck. Joe, you say, soft as your skin. Can you hear me? I lose my voice and cough. I'm not myself because I was just about to kill Nikki with a nightstick because he was trying to have sex with you. I'm dizzy, and you sound tipsy when you speak again. Joe, can you hear me? Bad signal, I say. I'm waiting for the train. Forward as a dictator, you make your demand. I need you to come over. Can you come over? Can you come over right now? I've never been so sure of anything in my life, and I answer strongly. Yes. I hit end, and I can't believe your timing. I need a minute to get my head right. You called. I ditch the nightstick in a trash heap. My hand is still sore from gripping it, and my heart hurts from the whiplash. You called. You're back. I'm calmer now, and I'm walking, and it will be nice to get out of here and get to you. You called, and I can't help but believe that for all of Nikki's idiocy, he might be good at what he does after all. Clearly, you are in a better place now. You called me, not him. I hop in a cab because I'm too happy to get on the subway. I wonder what you're wearing, and I can't get to you fast enough. I leave when bad things happen to good people in the back seat of the cab. I don't need it anymore. I have you. Chapter 41. Our IKEA pillow is still tagged, and it's underneath your table on the floor. I hold you in my arms, and you cry. You're drunk. And I don't ask any questions. I will not let you and your pillow get me down. Besides, you feel as good as I remember. Better. Your place is a mess, which makes me believe you really have been growing. There are curtains now, that's progress. And you're almost out of tears. I stroke your head and stare at our pillow and breathe you in. Your scent. Your apples rotting on the counter. I can't stop smiling. And the harder you cry, the broader I grin. And finally, you have nothing left and you stop. You whisper. Sorry. Oh, it's okay, I say. I can send you a dry cleaning bill. If you were Karen Minty, you'd laugh too hard, but you're you, and all you do is smile.
I don't remember the last time I laughed.
Just about 2 seconds ago, Beck. You stretch your arms above your head and twist to the left, to the right. And then your arms flop and you look at me.
You must think I'm nuts.
Not at all, I say, and I don't.
Oh, come on, Joe, I see you.
And we get together, and then I just disappear off the radar. I make a joke. Actually, I was in the south of France on a top-secret mission for the FBI. You don't laugh, and you're not in the mood for dumb jokes, and I love you for being so honest, so present, and all the hard work was worth it, because all of it was leading up to this moment. You speak. I kind of do wish you were in the FBI. Seriously, I say, and I don't like where this is going. You quiver. I don't. Peach is dead, Joe. And you sound exasperated, and this isn't supposed to happen. Peach is in Turks and Caicos, goddammit. Are you kidding?
They found her body in Rhode Island.
No.
Yes, you say.
No. Impossible. I put a ton of rocks in her pockets. When I walked her onto that jetty, she must have been a $1.50. This is bullshit. I did my job.
Did I zip her pockets?
Fuck yes, I zipped her pockets. Nothing is made well anymore. The zippers were plastic, now that I think about it, and they probably disintegrated. Fuck those zippers.
I just can't believe it, you say.
There are so many horrible things you could say right now, and what if you led me here under false pretenses, and what if the FBI is here, spying? Rhode Island?
Yep, you say. Rhode Island.
I talked to too many people in that state. I was sloppy and friendly, and there's Officer Nico and Dr. K and all those junkies and the guy at the garage. What if they all got together? What if they know? The mug of piss flashes through my mind's eye, and what have I done?
Her family has a place there, you say. We were there, and I thought she took off. I mean, she sent me a melodramatic email, but that's Peach. I didn't think she was, you know, serious.
Jesus, I say, and would you visit me in prison, or would you be afraid?
I figured she took off because she does that sometimes.
You pick up your bottle of diet root beer, and you take a swig, and I wish you would just keep going.
And for the past few months, I haven't heard from her, but you know those old friends that you can go ages without talking to, and then you talk, and everything's fine?
Hang on. You bury your head in your phone, and I don't know what you mean, because if I go more than a month without seeing Mr. Mooney, it's super awkward. But how can I think about Mr. fucking Mooney right now? Are you wearing a wire, Beck? Are you trying to get me to confess? Is that why you got curtains? I look at my watch. 10:43.
Sorry, you say. It was just school stuff. Anyway, where was I?
She disappeared.
She didn't disappear. She committed suicide.
Oh, Jesus. Praise Jesus.
I know, you say, and you finish your root beer. How did I not see it?
You're heading to the kitchen, getting the vodka out of the freezer, the glasses out of the sink. Karen Minty doesn't leave glasses in the sink, but Karen Minty doesn't have the capacity to cry like you do. And you're going to tell me a story. And Karen Minty can't tell a story.
I don't know where to begin.
At the beginning. You sit down next to me, and we won't kiss for a long time, but God, did I miss the nearness of you, the anticipation of your words, your voice.
So, we were in Little Compton. It's this beach community in Rhode Island. She was pretty depressed, but me too.
Remember that guy, Benji, my druggy ex?
I think so. Well, he died.
I mean, that was always possible, because he's crazy, but still, you say, and you bite your lower lip, you are pretty.
He dies, and then she dies. I'm Death Girl.
I love you for making this all about you. For giving yourself a name. You are so flagrantly you.
I tell you what you want to hear. Beck, you're not Deaf Girl. It just sounds like you know some troubled people. You cut me off. That's two of my friends dead in a matter of months. And you know what I think, Joe? I think this is the universe punishing me for being a fucking liar. I lie and say my dad is dead, and now my friends are dying. I mean, obviously, that's what's happening. Let it out, I say, because I know when you're drunk, there's no point in arguing the benefits of life without Peach and Benji. But it's not your fault. You huff. Like hell it isn't. So talk to me, I say. I'm here. It's fun to watch you try and decide whether to tell me about the massage session with Peach, and you decide against it. Peach left to go running, which she did every morning. But apparently this time, she filled her pockets with rocks. And it is my fault, Joe. I was the last one to see her alive. I should have known. I was the last one to see her alive, but never mind that. Beck, I say, you can't blame yourself for what she did. She was depressed. You knew that. You were a damn good friend, and this has nothing to do with you. You motion for me to stop talking, and I pour vodka into the dirty glasses, and you dig around for your phone, which has fallen into the sofa into a lot of other junk, and you scroll and find the email that Peach wrote to you, the one that I wrote. I know I'm not a suspect anymore, and I can't help but think that it's kind of hot, hearing my words come out of your mouth. You finish reading and look at me. Virginia Woolf. I should have known. And I did nothing. You can't save someone who doesn't want to be saved. But she did want to be saved, you say, and you pull your hair up into a high bun. I just couldn't do it. Couldn't do what? You gulp, and I remember you naked, and I want my turn and take a hefty sip. This has to stay right here for obvious reasons, but you have to know. She tried to fuck me, Joe. Oh, man. Yes, you're opening up, petal by petal. It's happening. I pushed her off, of course, right away, you say, and again, you can't resist lying, from stealing a little cash from the Monopoly board when the other players are out of the room. You are a cheater, to the bone, a renovator, and I admire you, Beck. You never stop making improvements on life. You have charisma. You have vision. Someday, maybe we'll have some beat-up farmhouse and you'll paint the walls until you find the right shade of yellow, and I'll tease you, but I'll love the way you look with paint on your face. This is where you do your real art, and this is where your magic happens. You need an audience, alive, me, not a shrink, not a computer. How'd she take it? Not well? Fuck, I say. And the saddest thing is, it's not the first time this happened. Fuck. You take a sip and you're too embarrassed to look at me. Or maybe you're just too drunk. Are you horrified? Beck, I say, and I rest my hand on your knee. I'm not horrified that your best friend was in love with you. I don't blame her. You come at me hard and whole, sloppy and groping. You tear your top off and your hot hands are underneath my shirt marked by your tears, and your kiss is wet and hungry, and you bite my lip and there is blood, a sweetness, a saltiness, a touch. You have my belt off in no time, a professional under the influence. This time when I fuck you, I am the mouse in your house, and you can't get rid of me, and you want to get rid of me because you hate how much you want me, how I own you when I'm inside of you, how you'll never want anything but me, Nikki who, and at some point your emotions all turn into one, your tears for Peach, your cunt throbbing for me, your tits humming because of me, all of you exists solely because of me, and I fuck the Peach out of you, I fuck the Benji out of you, and the Nikki out of you. And I am the only man in the world, and this time, I wake up first. I go into your bathroom, into your tub, and I piss all over the floor of the shower, and mark my place, my home, you. I take the IKEA pillow out from under the table, and rip off the tag and bring it back to bed. You're half asleep when I slip the pillow under your chin and you purr.
Joe.
When we get out of bed, we know that we're together now. It's not about whether we'll go out to breakfast, it's just a matter of deciding where to go. We sit across from each other at a diner, and we're there 6 hours because we can't get enough of each other.
I finally manage to pull myself away and take a leak, and when I'm gone, you email Lynn and Hannah. Holy fuck. Joe. When I get back to the table, we start all over again. Chapter 42. Our first 8 days together are the best days of my life. You have these plush giant robes from the Ritz-Carlton. You tell me this elaborate story about stealing them while on spring break with Lynn and Hannah. I love that you love to tell stories. You couldn't possibly know that I know that you stole them from Peach's place and I don't tell. We live in these robes and you like to entertain me, and you do. Day 2 of us. We're lounging around in our robes and you declare the rule of